and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I'm very excited about today's guest. He's a returnee. We last had him on to talk about his truly excellent book, American Carnage, which I still think is one of the easily one of the best books about the whole Trump era. Trivia question or answer to a trivia question. Tim and I actually used to be colleagues a million years ago at National Review when he was a political reporter briefly for us. I mean, it feels briefly to me in retrospect. Maybe you were there for like 8 years or something, and I was just day drinking so much it just doesn't seem like it. Tim had this BAFO piece that a lot of my colleagues and I were talking about in The Atlantic. We actually talked about it a bit on the Dispatch podcast about the state of the evangelical church. Let me call it up. How politics poisoned the evangelical church. And so I figure we talk about that, but maybe we can cram in some rank punditry as well. Tim, welcome back to The Remnant.
Jonah, great to be with you, my friend. Always game for some rank punditry. And yes, my stint at National Review was a little less than a year. I was a bit of a hired gun brought in for the campaign. So yeah, it was brief. You were doing a lot of day drinking, but it was brief.
Yeah. So maybe it's like it's the other way around. It's not like it seemed so long because I was doing so much day drinking that I just thought you were always around. But anyway, who knows? The toll it's taken on the mind from my lifestyle.
The first time we met, you may recall, was in a bar. In fact, in that little basement bar in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, I think. Right.
I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was you were there speaking.
And
I was on
kind of like a corporate retreat kind of hotel. It was the whole thing.
I think
was
so.
Strange.
Yeah. It was strange. Yeah. And I just looked over and did a double take and there you were. And so, yeah, in fact, yes, it was an appropriate place given all the day drinking, although this was nighttime, but yeah, it was great.
So, Dr. Alberta, why don't you sort of, before we get into the weeds on all of it, just sort of the piece is great. It's also tied in with your own personal experience, and upbringing. So why don't you just sort of tell the story of the piece, why you wrote it, why it's significant for you personally, and then we can sort of go off in a million different directions.
Yeah, sure. So I had written, with some frequency over the past decade or so about sort of the intersection of American evangelicalism with Republican politics, and typically the focus was on the Republican politics. And, the evangelicalism was viewed through the lens of a campaign or a certain candidacy or, a grassroots effort of some sort, but never necessarily looking in depth at evangelicalism itself and at sort of what I had seen as an evolution, a slow but steady evolution in the church during my lifetime. And this was something that was of a lot of interest to me because I grew up in the evangelical church. I'm a pastor's kid. My dad was the senior pastor of the church in our hometown in Brighton, Michigan. And our denomination was the EPC, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. So a pretty conservative theologically and kind of culturally / politically denomination. And, I had sort of watched in my lifetime as politics. I had a line in the piece where I described this from another pastor, and it rang very true with my experience, that politics had gone from sort of the periphery of church life to the heart of church life in my lifetime. There was just sort of a mission creep there that, at one point it was just a sermon every year on Right to Life Sunday about abortion and with some, very explicit political partisan undertones, and that sort of would begin to it began to snowball a little bit. It went from just the abortion argument to an argument about something a little bit less biblically explicit, I suppose one might say. At least maybe that was my interpretation. And that just sort of continued. And it wasn't just in my home church or from my dad's sermons. It was just in the culture. And you know, my mom worked at the church as well. And so I grew up literally physically in the church. I mean, my like summer vacation was spent in the church. I grew up there with those people and with, you know, other people in our community at other churches. And so it was just something that had always vexed me a bit. And then really, Jonah, I think it was during the Trump years when things started to accelerate and intensify in ways that kind of troubled me. And it wasn't just the presidency of Trump, mind you. It was this combination of, you know, you had the you know, racial injustice protests and with the killing of George Floyd and the conversations about racial reconciliation in the church. And that really divided a huge swath of the evangelical world. And you had the question of Me Too and sexual abuse, sexual assault and cover-ups and accountability. And that was another huge flashpoint in the evangelical world. And then I think really the single biggest thing is then you had COVID and you had churches closing down and you had this fear that was suddenly realized among a lot of evangelicals that sort of the big, bad, secular, liberal government was coming for them. And I think that, even more so than Trumpism, was really the moment that set this thing into sort of a full tailspin. And you could just see all across the country, you would hear stories and in my reporting, I was at churches all over the place, coast to coast, where you would just hear the same things over and over again, that these churches that had been together for 30 or 40, 50 years were suddenly splitting overnight and people were leaving and going to new places. Anyway, that's a long descriptor for you, but that was really what I wanted to investigate here with my reporting, is what exactly is happening on the ground in these places.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll read something from the piece in a second, but the COVID part of it, I think, you know, I think a lot of people who did the shutdowns, particularly in the beginning, were well-intentioned, and I don't buy any to date any, I don't know of any COVID conspiracies or conspiracy adjacent theories that I buy. Right. But at the same time, the dismissiveness about the real weird damage that the lockdowns and the mask mandates did, sometimes irrationally, right? You can blame everybody. It's sort of like there people had irrational responses to irrationally aggressive processes. But regardless, I think historians are going to look back on just some profound upheavals to the culture that were part of it. And I think this fits into it. I also think, I mean, look, we've had mass shooters before COVID, obviously, tragically. But like this evil cretin in Buffalo, part of the reason he got radicalized, as he admits in the manifesto, is he was just sort of locked in his house marinating in 4chan garbage for 2 years. And it just, you know, and I like, you have to think, I know the plural of anecdote isn't data, but all you need is a few more anecdotes of people who have sort of gotten messed in the head from the COVID lockdowns. And it's going to be, we could have all sorts of problems going forward. And, you know, the rate of people just of truancy and not signing up for school anymore is a huge problem. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that I don't think we've really processed that are sort of a bulge in the snake. But we can return to that in a second. You have this line, which I think captures the piece really well. You say, if this is a tale of two churches, it is also the tale of churches everywhere. It's the story of millions of American Christians who, after a lifetime spent considering their political affiliations in the context of their faith, are now considering their faith affiliations in the context of their politics. And I think that sort of captures the sort of the gist of it, is that it used to be about a little too much chocolate in the peanut butter, and now it's all about all the peanut butter getting into the chocolate, as it were. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
It does.
And so one of the benefits I have of having a bunch of colleagues, including David French, but also several refugees from World Magazine, is I have a bunch of people at the Dispatch who actually know a lot more about the evangelical stuff than I do as a secular Jew from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And so I got a couple of questions from them I wanted to throw at you.
Fire away.
First of all, as I heard you talk about on TV, you were talking pretty, I mean, it's pretty obvious in the piece, but you're talking explicitly about the white evangelical church, because there are the same process doesn't seem to be going on in parallel in the black church, which is also a robust and serious denomination in America, right? Or part of American religion.
Yeah. The short answer is yes. I mean, the piece is focused on the white evangelical church for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I grew up in the white evangelical church. That's my sort of tradition. That's my subset of American Christendom. And this sort of political radicalism that is infecting, American Christianity is really most prevalent inside the white evangelical church. I mean, I cite polling in the piece that, looks at everything from, conspiracies that the election was stolen from Donald Trump to belief that that QAnon is real, to refusal to get the COVID vaccine and belief that the COVID vaccine is dangerous. I mean, the number one religious group, the number one religious demographic in this country by a mile that believes in all of these things is white evangelicals. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was focusing on. And I've had a few people say to me, the black church has been explicitly political for forever. Well, why not write about them? And to which I've said, both of the things I just said, which is that I'm not, a black evangelical, obviously. And also, I'm focusing on this particular strand of sort of political radicalism. But beyond that, I had another person email me and say, well, what about some of these left-wing synagogues, preaching politics? And I said, well, I must have missed all the guys marching on the Capitol wearing yarmulkes and with their pitchforks and menorahs, right? On January 6th. It's just not something that strikes me as anywhere near the sort of existential dilemma as what's happening with white evangelicalism.
Yeah, and also I actually think all of those are perfectly valid things for someone to write articles about. It is not a criticism. I mean, this is we've both been around the horn writing things for a very long time, and one of the weakest forms of criticism is, why didn't you write the piece I wanted you to write rather than the piece that you wrote that bothers me, right? I mean,
exactly.
And sometimes the whataboutism is entirely fair, to the extent that, like, yeah, that other article that you think I should have written is a good article for someone to write. Maybe I'll write it one day, but it doesn't detract from the merits of the thing I actually wrote. Right. I mean, it's a version of the dumbest form of Twitter, which is, why didn't you tweet about what I wanted you to tweet about? Why did you tweet about, what you wanted to tweet about?
Right. Right. Like every time somebody writes something about Bo Biden and they're ratioed on Twitter with, like, oh, do Jared Kushner next.
Right.
It's like, yeah, okay.
Two things can be true. They can both be problematic people with serious political baggage, right?
You know?
So another question that I just, a colleague asked me, this is from our Slack channel. I said, ask people what they wanted me to talk to you about. And one said, worth asking if the church is getting caught up in this are ones where people are more recently active in a religious sense, but with longstanding interest in politics. Like, are the evangelical voters who supported Trump but never really attended church and are going to church now that there are pastors offering political red meat from the pulpit, right? So I guess the part of the question is, did the Trump phenomenon actually drive, not just cause people to switch churches, as you write about it at quite a bit of detail, but it just sort of drove people who weren't particularly faith driven to show up at essentially political rallies that called themselves religious services?
It's a good question. Let me give you a nuanced answer. I think the short answer is not really. Now, there are, without question, and I write about this a little bit in the piece, these alliances that have formed in the last few years between some of these kind of right-wing evangelical churches and, grassroots organizations locally that are sort of explicitly partisan or political in their aims. Those alliances, because oftentimes the churches are offering their physical space, their sanctuaries, to these organizations to come in and hold some event and do their volunteer training or whatever it may be, there's no question that that is then bringing in non-churchgoers to this church setting, and some of them, a light bulb is going off, and they're saying, "Oh, I could get into this. This is my kind of Christianity." Right? There's no question that that's happening at some scale. From everything I can see, though, Jonah, it's not a huge scale. It's not the preponderance of the phenomenon here. What I've seen time and time and time again is that actually a lot of the folks who are gravitating towards these right-wing churches, they have belonged for many, many years, in some cases many decades, to other churches that were never political at all or were never political enough for their taste. But, you know, they'd stuck around anyway. They liked the preaching. They liked their Bible study. They liked the community there. It was never a hill that they were going to die. And then, again, these last few years, everything sort of everything fell apart in a lot of these churches. And again, particularly going back to the COVID shutdown, you know, I can't stress this point enough, Jonah. I reported from a handful of different churches, different parts of the country, where the physical shuttering of the church was only 4 or 5 weeks. Only in some cases it was only 3 or 4 Sundays that they did not physically meet, and this was at the very beginning of COVID, right? And then they reopened after a month or so, but a chunk of their congregations never came back because mm-hmm. they viewed it as an act of cowardice, as an act of betrayal, that this was exactly when we needed the church the most and you weren't there for us. And you can guess where most of those folks wound up, right? They didn't join a Methodist congregation somewhere. They didn't go Lutheran all of a sudden, right? Like, most of these folks moved to very conservative, very outspoken politically churches, many of them non-denominational, many of them charismatic churches, where there was just this overt embrace of partisan politics from the pulpit. And in those settings, again, a number of them that I visited, when I would talk with people there, frankly, that was part of my hypothesis. 15 months ago at the beginning of this project, I expected to find a lot of people who had never been in church before and were suddenly, by sort of this confluence of events, finding themselves in these kind of right-wing churches. I really expected that to be the case more than it was, when in fact, the vast, vast majority of the folks I would encounter had been in church for a very long time, but they were just relocating.
So we should, for the benefit of listeners like me, to butcher the PBS slogan, we should do a little clarification on terminology here, because your point about them, they didn't go become Lutherans or Methodists, I vaguely get. But, you know, like, other people might not. And one of the questions, actually, some of my colleagues brought up, which is a point that David French has made as well, and who really loved your piece, is that a lot of this stuff, and again, I could be butchering it because it is not my vernacular, but that the Pentecostals are much more into this stuff, and Pentecostals and other charismatics, if I'm using this correctly, are not as that some of them are don't even use the evangelical label, that there is a schism of sorts there. If I'm butchering that, I apologize to all parties concerned. I probably know more about Zoroastrianism than I do about some of this stuff. Can you just sort of lay out the anatomy of these different, sort of organs of the American church a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you didn't really butcher it at all, Jonah. You were pretty much spot on. I mean, so I'll do it briefly so as to not put any of your listeners.
I got the Catholics figured out. Okay. I know who they are.
Yeah, the Catholics are easy. Don't pat yourself on the back too hard. The Catholics are roughly divided into the people who are really serious about being Catholic and the folks who are culturally Catholic. And I'm sure that 10-second descriptor is going to earn us both a bunch of hate mail after this publishes.
But, having worked at National Review for 20 years, like, and having married a Catholic, I feel like I know where the different groups are. But
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, yeah, Catholics, that's a different piece. But yeah, so within the Protestant, underneath the American Protestant umbrella, you know, I mentioned charismatic churches. You know, so you could for, again, for the purposes of this discussion, use you know, charismatics and Pentecostals as sort of interchangeable. Many charismatics are not denominational; they don't belong to, you know, they don't affiliate with other charismatic churches, with other Pentecostal churches. But many of the traditions are the same. And you're right. I have, although I don't think it's a, I don't think it's the sort of self-identification crisis within the charismatic community vis-a-vis evangelicalism, as it is in the more sort of moderate, dare I say, traditional wing of the American Christian community. Specifically, what I mean by that is, it's true, I suppose, that you do have some charismatics who would not readily identify as evangelical, although I don't think that's a huge number. On the flip side of it, you do have, increasingly so, lots of Christians who come from more traditional denominational background, you know, and particularly backgrounds that are not as theologically conservative. So that's why I mentioned, you know, the Methodists, for example, the Lutherans, the Episcopalians. You will have folks in those churches more and more who may not be comfortable with the label of evangelical because of the political connotation. And that's what I tried to get at very early in the piece in writing about how evangelicalism had really, in my lifetime, morphed from what was understood as kind of a spiritual identity mm-hmm. to a political identity. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I had this, I didn't have time to write about it in the piece, but I had this fascinating experience at a church where I met with a number of, with the church's leadership and with a number of their members, their longest tenured members, many of them elders in the church. And we had a little ice cream social on a Sunday night. I'd been reporting there for a little while. And so this was kind of my time to play Frank Luntz and get everybody in a room together and throw out some words and get them to kind of disagree and see where the fault lines were. And what was so interesting, Jonah, is that the conversation was really kind of slow for a little while. Folks were, I think, very wary of one another and of saying the wrong thing. And there was obviously some tension beneath the surface in this church that was kind of simmering. And so, and I couldn't quite figure out, and I felt like I was failing in this entire exercise. So I finally, I paused and I said, okay, let me ask everybody a question. How many of you would identify yourselves as evangelicals? And there were 30 people in the room and 16 hands went up. And I said, how many of you would not identify? And 14 hands went up. And I said, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Can you all tell me why? For the first batch of you who said yes, go around. And they all gave the description basically saying, you know, we're called as part of the Great Commission. We're called to evangelize. We're called to go out into the world and make disciples for Christ and draw people to him, bring people into the church, grow the community of believers. So yes, I consider myself an evangelical. So it was all very much oriented around the mission of the church, the mission of the gospel, their individual mission as believers. The 14 who didn't identify that way, their explanations up and down the line were, I can't be comfortable using that term anymore because of what evangelicals have done politically, mm-hmm. because of how they've affiliated themselves with Trump, because of all the scandals going back to Jim and Tammy Faye, because of all of the cultural and political attachments, the connotations to evangelicalism that we feel have done more harm to the gospel than good, we are no longer comfortable identifying that way. And I found that to be just, it was like, as a matter of social science, it was just a totally fascinating exchange. Mm-hmm. And very quickly from that point, Jonah, the conversation started really moving because once that initial fault line was sort of established, everything else we discussed, you know, COVID policies, masking and vaccines and, you know, racial reconciliation in the church, gay marriage, all of these other things were neatly cleaved along that initial fault line.
One of the things that I'm, you know, one of the things I really appreciated about the piece, I mean, other than the fact that you actually went and did reporting and just didn't look at Pew polls or whatever, not that polls aren't a valuable piece of evidence, but they don't convey all the information that we need. But, you know, you focus on two different pastors. One is sort of a, for in crude terms, a MAGA pastor, right? And his flock is growing. What was it? Brolin is his name?
Bolin, yeah.
Bolin. Sorry. And the other one is Brown, Pastor Brown, who is both conservative, right? And in fact, the MAGA guy is more of a, he's an ex left winger, kind of ex hippie, which I think is sort of psychologically important in some ways, which we can get into. But, and meanwhile, Brown is a lifelong small C conservative, pro life guy. And what I sort of find fascinating about it is that it speaks to me as, you know, like my big listeners of this podcast know this, that like my big spiel for the last like 7 years is you can boil down most journalistic ethics and most ethical questions in our work lives to basically, you know, one commandment: don't lie, right? Don't say things that are not true. That doesn't mean you can't be wrong. And that doesn't mean that your opinion can't be contestable, right? I mean, obviously those things are all true, but don't knowingly say things that you don't believe to be true and present them as if they are true. And I, you know, this is what kind of radicalized me in my refusal to go along with the Trump stuff, was I just watched people say one thing to me in person and then say a completely different thing in print or on TV. And I was just so disgusted by it because I kind of thought like we all had the same basic rules in my line of work, is that you can take whatever hot take position you want. You can be deliberately provocative as long as you clue in the reader that you're taking an extreme position to make a point, but you're not supposed to lie, right? And like people went around saying that Donald Trump is a brilliant constitutionalist and all these other things. And I just, it drove me crazy. And, or maybe it drove me sane, whatever. People will disagree on that. I have particular sympathy for this Pastor Brown, I can't remember his first name, who doesn't want to talk about politics, but he also thinks that one of the key commandments of being a Christian is discernment and the need to bear truthful witness about things, right? To tell the truth. And so because he pushes back on conspiracy theories and slanders and that kind of thing, he gets accused of being too political, when in reality what he's trying to do is just focus on the truth. But because people are sort of hungry for this sort of politicized infotainment stuff, it makes him seem political by trying to push back on the overly political stuff. And I just think that's a really interesting dilemma for, you know, because I feel like I've had similar experiences. And then the other part of it is this Bolin guy who like is just pretty honest, is like the way you fill the pews is you give the people what they want. And it just seems to me that like there's another analogy in that to our line of work, which is that so much of media these days tells their audiences what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. And like you run into some serious theological trouble when you start just telling the people what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear, because there's a whole point about the truth of gospel and, you know, and not putting your faith in princes. And if you start saying you can put your faith in princes, that kind of pandering can really be corrupting to the church.
I'm really glad you said that last part, Jonah, because I mean, I agree with everything you just said. But you know, in our line of work, the stakes are really high, right? We are so often writing about, you know, some of the most powerful figures in the world people who have incredible authority or proximity to authority and influence over events that shape history. And the stakes are very high. But I think one would argue, I certainly would, that the stakes are even higher inside a place of worship. If you are a Bible-believing Christian, and if you are to really study what the Scripture says, it's very clear that we don't put our faith in princes, and that this world is a fleeting, forgettable place that is meant to be sort of infinitesimal in comparison to eternity and to all that awaits. And the problem, I think, is one of when you talk about discernment and truth, which are obviously kind of the big, bold themes of the piece, the problem really, I think, can be boiled down to credibility, mm-hmm. right? It's the reason that this pastor, Ken Brown, at his church is struggling and is really decided to kind of lay it all on the line in confronting his people, his flock there at his church, is not because he's annoyed by their political points of view, not because he disagrees with them on certain things, although he certainly does, but he views their credibility as Christians as being significantly diminished when they are in the public sphere, on social media, out in the community, even inside the church, over coffee between activities, after the service concludes, giving voice to things that are not true, and fomenting falsehood, as he wrote in the piece. And of course, I revisit this time and time again, but really at the very end of the piece, especially when I'm sitting down with the other pastor, with Bill Bolin, and I'm documenting to him, we'd spent a few months at that point having some conversations, and I'd been listening to a lot of his sermons, following his Facebook page, and I've been documenting all these things that were just wrong, some of which, the word lie is obviously loaded because it assumes that he knows something, but at least some of these things were clearly untrue when he said them, and he's a smart enough guy. I had to assume that these are lies and that these are falsehoods, and that he was sharing them with his people. And I asked him after one thing in particular, just like this flagrantly, just egregiously wrong thing that he posted on social media. And I told him, I showed him the evidence. I said, this is not right. And he said, oh yeah, I realized that after the fact, but it was still active on his Facebook page even during that conversation. And I said, doesn't this worry you that if you're getting stuff like this wrong, then people might wonder, well, is he getting the much bigger stuff wrong? The stuff like sanctity and salvation and eternal life. Doesn't your credibility as a witness for Christ, as a teacher of truth, doesn't it suffer when you're objectively egregiously wrong on some of this other stuff? And he said, he said, I disagree. I make a distinction between, political statements and spiritual statements. And, that's okay. So he's free to make that distinction. But I do think that out in the broader culture, part of the reason that, and this is documented over, I didn't just read Pew polls, as you said earlier, but read some polling, and it is clearly documented over a period of decades that the perception of the confidence in the American church is in free fall, and this is part of the reason because I think there is a serious credibility crisis for a lot of folks who look at the alliances that the evangelical movement has made and the sort of shameless opportunism and the transactionalism and the willingness to go along with things that they know are not true. And so the outside world looks at that and says, well, if they're willing to abide this thing that they know is not true, then why would I ever trust them about this thing that they swear is true, this other thing?
So, I mean, as much as I stand by all the stuff I said about, you know, it's sort of a cheap criticism about the article you didn't write. You know, one of the things that a bunch of people, not my colleagues, but like on Twitter, I asked people if they had questions, and proving once again, it's stupid to ask people if they have questions. Not that I didn't get some smart ones, but it's so difficult to pick out the wheat from the chaff on some of these things. I particularly like the guy who says you'll never ask this on your quote unquote podcast. He put podcast in air quotes because I get it when people do that, or like your so-called journalism, right? At least like there's an idea of like the ideal of what journalism is and why you would put it in scare quotes. But like, is this not a podcast because you disagree with something? But anyway, I just thought that was really funny. But you know, a bunch of people were like, well, you know, and again, I think there's some truth to this. That part of the problem that you get with the evangelical side of things, or the conservative side of things, you know, in American Christianity, is a response to the politicization of the left side of American Christianity, right? And that you have, and this again is a perfectly useful analog for the same kind of culture war stuff in our schools, in corporate America, in politics in general, is that you have one side doing something that triggers the other side, that gives them a permission structure to trigger the other side, right? And it sort of never ends. But like, you have this definition, or how do you say definition? You talk a lot about keeping politics, or the challenge of keeping politics out of the pews. But some political issues just definitely do have legitimate religious resonance. And I'm not saying that you have to pick one side or the other. I don't know God's will, but like the issue of transgender, you concede the issue of abortion, right? There are lots of issues. You know, you're talking about the denomination that's going to be splitting in half over gay pastors, right? I mean, I'm whatever my own personal views, I mean, I'm perfectly at peace with gay marriage and all of these things. And I think churches should be allowed to do what they want to do. But like, I don't think it's illegitimate to think that you can't, like, let me put it this way. I don't think it's illegitimate for the Catholic Church to say they shouldn't have female priests, right? It's not my fight, but I don't think it's an illegitimate, I don't think there are illegitimate views on either side of that. How do you what's the line drawing process here, do you think? Because lots of people like say, oh, look what these woke pastors are doing and saying, and look how they defended violence with the Black Lives Matter riots and all these kinds of things. And like, if I were attending a church and I had a clergyman, you know, defending some of that stuff, I'm not sure I would want to be there. How do you distinguish what is the course of discernment between a political issue that is rightly something that crosses the theological blood-brain barrier, and what is one that doesn't?
Yeah, so this is a super important question, Jonah, and I'll just give the disclaimer up front that I don't know that I'm the person best qualified to answer it. I would love to have a couple of big theological brains in the room with us and kick this around a little bit, but I'll give you my best whack at it, just from my own personal perspective as a Christian and as a journalist who spent a lot of time working on these things. So I don't, you know, as far as where the lines are drawn, I don't know that there are any lines to be drawn necessarily, but I guess I think probably you need a ground rule or two in place. And maybe the first ground rule is just observing very simply that, you know, God does not play for or belong to or own stock in either of these political parties, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not being cute when I say that, I think that that is sort of the root of a lot of this, because if you were to assume that that the Almighty is more aligned with your political causes than with the other tribes, what it then sort of very naturally leads you to do is to selectively apply scripture to the things that you care about and sort of ignore anything that doesn't support what you care about. It's sort of like Martin Luther King Jr. Day, when everybody posts a Martin Luther King Jr. quote to Twitter that sort of supports their personal or political point of view, right? And it's kind of a choose your own adventure thing. And what you see inside churches is, you know, I had this conversation with a gentleman back early this year. We were having coffee and he was saying, you know, I just don't really want politics in the church at all. And he's a very conservative guy. And I said, well, you know, and then he said, except for abortion, I think that's, he said, I think that is a kind of an explicitly political issue. And which I've heard that plenty from a lot of different folks. And I said, okay, well, just game this out with me for a minute, just playing devil's advocate, no pun intended. You know, what about poor people? What about poverty? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, Jesus spent more time talking about poverty than just about anything else in the Gospels, right? And he said, maybe. I guess it would depend sort of how poor. I said, okay, what about refugees? What about immigrants? He said, I wouldn't want to really get into that. That gets a little bit too political. So we sort of went up and down the list. And by the time the discussion was done, he said, I'll give you that. It almost has to be an all or nothing thing, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know if it has to be an all or nothing thing. Again, I'm not smart enough to know the answers to this. There's obviously quite a slippery slope involved. You do have some churches that are just really, really, really outspoken on just one or two sort of pet causes, if you will, and then silent on the rest of it. You have other churches that try to be a little bit more holistic with regard to with regard to what Jesus said and what he did, and kind of let the chips fall where they may. And then you have other churches that are really careful not to sort of say anything that could be perceived as, like, I had a pastor a while back tell me that he had made some comments about the beauty of God's creation and our stewardship thereof, and a bunch of angry emails after the sermon accusing him of being a tree hugger. And he was like, whoa. And this is a guy who's pretty careful to stay away from any of the political stuff. And he's like, he said that, you know, that just reaffirmed to him how incredibly careful you have to be. Like, he's already walking on eggshells, and here he has this sort of unwitting slip up, and suddenly he's a Greenpeace activist. So it's, I don't know that there are any lines. I think there, again, I would say the one ground rule should be in place. I'll finish here, Jonah. I think that probably as far as ground rules or lines to draw, however you want to think about it, the pastors that I've spent time with who have really reflected on this a lot and who I think are doing a really commendable job, whatever their personal politics are, whatever the politics of their congregations are, whatever approach they've taken, and it's not a uniform thing, it's not a binary thing, there's a lot of different ways to approach this. I think the guys who are doing this right, they are being very intentional about preaching the gospel and doing it in the context of the gospel. In other words, not trying to, not being very overt and really sort of, jamming it down your throat with making the political points from the pulpit. And also not doing a lot of winking and nodding and sort of speaking in not so subtle metaphors, trying to connect, you know, the message from the gospel that Sunday to the culture war or to the political fight happening just outside the church. Instead, they're being very shrewd in preaching what on whatever the substance is from the pulpit, and not being coy to sort of avoid connecting it to what's going on in the outside world, but basically presenting it to their people and challenging them to take that lesson and apply it however they see fit, right? And in other words, it's stripping away any of the sort of manifest political connotations from scripture and presenting scripture as what it is, right? As what these preachers say to their people every week, that this is the holy word of God and you should treat it as such. Don't pollute it by trying to inject politics into it. Don't try and tie it in cleverly to some issue du jour. Just preach the word to your people. Make sure they understand that it has eternal implications. And when they leave, trust that they can be discerning enough to understand its application out in the real world without having to cram it down their throats.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can, I want to do a little bit of rank punditry, but the thing that, like, sort of, there are two things that sort of popped out at me in this, in your piece, that pinged my sort of intellectual historian portfolio. One is, I had not really realized that Paul Weyrich and those guys were post-millennialists. And I know a little bit about that. I don't want to, like, conjure my friend David Bonson, who will come on and lecture me about all this stuff for an hour. But the social gospel movement of the progressives in the beginning of the 20th century was very post-millennial. It was, it really believed that you could use the state to bring about the kingdom of heaven on earth, you know, in this life, not in the reserve for the afterlife and all of that. And I think it's very, I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't realize that those guys, knowing what I know about conservatism and knowing what I know about this stuff, that I didn't really put those things together with Weyrich and those guys. And then, you know, the other thing that sort of comes out at me in the piece is there's, one of my favorite books. It's a bit of a stem winder, is this book by this guy, Julian Benda, called The Treason of the Intellectuals. And it was written in the late teens, early 20s. He kind of predicted World War II. And part of his argument was, it was this sort of like tirade about the corruption of the intellectual class, which in the original French, it's called the treason of the clerks, to include priests and, you know, sort of the thought leaders, as smug people would call themselves today. And his, and one of his big indictments was of Christian leaders and nationalists who would claim, you know, all these different isms would claim Jesus as the first progenitor of their ism. So you had all these people saying, oh, Christ was the first nationalist, or Christ was the first eugenicist, or Christ was the first socialist, or, and you can go down a very long list. And it seems to me that, like, what we witness, particularly during the Trump era, is a real version of that. And what Benda was saying is that what has happened, the fundamental treason of the intellectuals was, they'd committed themselves to the organization of political hatreds, and they drafted any causes or ideas and subordinated them to their political hatreds. And when you look at the stuff that, like, Charlie Kirk and Jerry Falwell Jr. and those guys did in the service of sort of a MAGA con job to the role of Christianity in public life, I can't get angry on behalf of Christians, because it's not my job to be angry on behalf of Christians. But the way in which my understanding of what is best about Christianity got subordinated to, like, the Falkirk Center at Liberty University and all that kind of thing is so grotesque. It feels like, you know, the selling of indulgences or something to me. And yet, if you criticize, when I criticize those guys, I get accused of being anti-Christian by people. And it's just all very, very weird. Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there. You can respond to it or not, or we can just move straight into the rank punditry part.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I'm angry. I had lots of interesting emails over the past week and a half or so since the piece published, and also got some nice ones and people, you know, saying, yeah, I've been trying to figure out what's going on in my church. This kind of really hit home. And of course, I got a lot of notes from pastors who are sort of deeply disillusioned at this point, some of whom have retired from preaching and sharing their stories with me.
but I got some really angry notes and some really kind of ugly notes from people. And one in particular was from a woman who attended my home church and said, you know, your dad would be ashamed of you, yada, yada, and said, you know, you sound so angry. And I thought, I am angry. I'm angry because exactly what you just said a minute ago, John. I mean, you put it perfectly, that the purest, most beautiful, most sort of selfless and self-sacrificial parts of Christianity have been tossed in the back seat or even tossed out of the vehicle altogether by these forces of nationalism and tribal identity and paranoia and this, you know, Chicken Little, sky is falling, this is the last stand for Christian America as we know it, you know, therefore, you know, the ends are always going to justify the means. There's just this sort of existential hysteria that has hijacked American Christianity. And the shame of it is, I was having this conversation with someone just the other day. As with so many other dilemmas we face in American life, in examining all of the sort of breakage and the fracturing of different communities and institutions, it's often, you know, the loudest voices who are winning, and they are wildly disproportionate to what their numbers really are. And I think that that's true here. I don't think that it's anywhere near a majority of American Christians or anywhere near a majority of white evangelical Christians who are extremist in their views and who are allowing the politics of Trumpism and vaccine denialism and Q to sort of subjugate the gospel of Jesus Christ. But it's enough of them, and they have enough of a voice, they have enough of a platform, they have enough kind of organizational savvy and kind of cultural leverage points at their disposal to really throw this thing into turmoil. And that's what they've done. And that does make me angry. It makes me angry on a number of different levels. And I, you know, maybe I'd be better served in suppressing that anger a little bit, because apparently it came through in the piece. But yeah, I am angry.
No, as someone who's made a living often writing angry, your piece did not come across as particularly angry to me, but you know.
more sort of sad and heartbroken than angry.
That's right? The way it came across to me. And look, I mean, part of the point is like, and again, it's analogous to conservatism, is that there's nothing more annoying than people speaking on behalf of your cause wrongly. Right. Because then there are people out there who think that they're speaking for you and they're not. And yet there's this sort of popular front tribal attitude that says, no, you can't disagree internally. All of disagreement has to be focused outward, which is basically saying you got to make room for these people. And, I see it more in like my fights with people about like the alt-right. Like, you know, I spent 20 years at National Review with, you know, V-Dare readers sending me emails talking about how the world would be better off if all of my family had been put in ovens, right? And it's like, seems to me like as a political proposition or an intellectual one or a moral one, I don't want to hang out with these people. You know, I don't want them as like part of my team. And people are like, you know, well, why are you making a fuss about that? You should be making a fuss about, you know, what the left is doing. And I make fuss about the left all the time. But like, there's a different moral urgency when people are speaking in your name or that you're associating with you. And it's an important distinction to make. All right, very quickly, because I know we don't want to keep you past the time we told you we would, but broad brushstrokes, where do you see, like, I don't want to talk about the midterms per se, but, like, you know, the future of the GOP. Do you think Trump's going to run? Do you think if he runs, a bunch of people don't? Are we going to have another collective action problem of a 16-way race that almost guarantees Trump would win? What do you think the next couple of years look like?
You know, yeah, it's interesting, Jonah. It's sort of, so first of all, I do think he'll run. I mean, I could be wrong on that. Just my general sense from, everything I know about the man and, everything I know about some of the people close to him who are in his ear, it just all adds up to, you know, he can't live without this. I mean, just as recently as a week ago, I was talking to a pretty prominent, pretty plugged in Republican who had just had a conversation with Trump the day before, and who said, you know, that they were, he invited him down to Mar-a-Lago so they get ready for the big one, quote unquote. And this was in the context of some primaries unfolding here in 2022. And he said, you know, get down here so we can talk about the big one, right? 2024. And that's pretty consistent with what I've been hearing from other folks as well, that it's just that it's, listen, I mean, this is a guy who sort of stews and marinates every day in mm-hmm. what happened in 2020. All of his conversations, his relationships, like, it's not, you know, like, he goes out and plays golf, I guess, but otherwise, this is not someone who, you know, like, sometimes somebody in their 70s who gets out of politics, like, they say they want to go spend time with their grandchildren, and they actually want to go spend time with their grandchildren. That's what they're mm-hmm. going to go do. Trump's not going to go spend time with his grandchildren. I mean, it's yeah. you know, and of course, now I'll get hate mail from people saying, how dare you say he's not a good grandfather? That's not how the man is wired. He wants to be front and center. He wants to be in the arena, and I suspect that he will be. Now, the question really is, you know, back in 2020, no Republican was willing to step forward and challenge him mano a mano. And of course, mano a mano is probably the only way that someone stops him from winning the nomination, because once you get to a point where there are two or three or four challengers, and certainly anywhere north of three, I would argue, the anti-Trump vote gets diluted to the point where he can win pretty easily with a plurality. Mm-hmm. Which is what he did for the most part in 2016, of course. It wasn't until mid to late March of 2016, when the field had winnowed down to three and Kasich was barely breaking single digits, that Trump started topping 50%. Trump was winning all of those primaries in 2016 with somewhere between 26 and 35% of the vote. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not a handful of these different folks throw their hats in the ring. Obviously, DeSantis gets the most ink, gets the most buzz, but I think there's a real question about whether he has the stomach for a fight with Trump. Mm-hmm. There are lingering questions that continue to haunt him, and I suspect would continue to haunt him, about his inability to have any continuity with a political organization. He's churned through staffers at sort of a prodigious clip. He's got a kind of a trail of disgruntled former employees. A lot of people didn't like working for him, don't like him personally. And that's not just a cosmetic problem for a politician. That's something that speaks directly to your sort of organizational capacities and your ability to build out a really, really good team of loyal people who can help you win a national campaign. And so I think DeSantis has some issues he would have to work through. And then look, I mean, some of the other folks who we talk about, you just kind of go up and down the line, whether it's, you know, Nikki Haley or whether it's Ted Cruz or Tom Cotton. You know, I'm obviously leaving out a dozen names, but, you know, every single one of these people has at least one or two huge asterisks attached to their name. And some of it relates to just sort of raw political talent. Some of it relates to their ability to raise money. But I think much of it comes back to just sort of how many of these folks had already kind of bent the knee to Trump and kind of subjugated themselves to him. And will find themselves in a position where they've either been too loyal to run against them, or they've sort of wavered in their loyalty but then gone back on it. I mean, like Nikki Haley is a perfect example, who's taken every imaginable stance vis-a-vis Trump that one can take. And so if she were to run against him, how does that play? It's just not clear to me what it looks like. I mean, you know, I wrote a couple of months ago about Will Hurd when he released his book. And a lot of people sort of laughed me off of Twitter for suggesting that Hurd could run and could potentially put together kind of a dark horse, long shot campaign. But at least with Hurd, there's sort of, I think, a clearer, I certainly would not go to Vegas and put your money on him. But I with somebody like that, who sort of comes from a bit of a cleaner separation from Trump and is running a bit of a more asymmetrical campaign against Trump, maybe somebody like that emerges, Jonah. But at this point, I think that if you're a realist, you have to look at this and say, A, yes, he probably runs, and B, if he runs, then yes, he's probably the nominee.
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally with you on the crowded field gives you Trump thing, right? I mean, this is the point from 2016. It's sort of on the bingo card for Dispatch Podcast, because we called the belling the cat problem, right? It goes back, I think, to Aesop, where it's in every mouse's interest to put a bell on the cat, but it's in no individual mouse's interest to be the one to put the bell on it. And so let's, in 2016, you just had one candidate after other using, you know, Trump as a blocking tackle to take care of their opponents without actually taking on Trump, until it became too late to do anything about Trump. And I think that collective action problem is real. I'm not sure. I mean, you might be right, but I'm not sure you're right about the, if you were loyal to Trump, you can't run against him now argument. I mean, I think it depends on the personalities, because like Mike Pence is going to run, right? I'm not a huge Mike Pence fan. But no one can say he wasn't a loyal Trump surrogate until January 6th. And I think Pompeo certainly wants to run. And I think those guys can sell the idea of being, you know, one of the, let me put it this way. One of the really interesting things I think that is emerging, particularly out of Pennsylvania, is that Trump is essentially the establishment now, and that MAGA is a distinct thing from Trump loyalty, right? You know, had Kathy Barnett saying the MAGA movement is bigger than Trump. You know, he transitioned to our values. We didn't transition to his. You have a lot of candidates who are Trumpy or MAGA-y, but who didn't get Trump's endorsement, you know? And it seems to me that, look, I don't like this phenomenon, but at the same time, it's you just look at Georgia with Brian Kemp and all that. Kemp sounds pretty Trumpy, except for the fact that he's not a Trump loyalist, right? And he's going to win. And so it seems to me that it is possible that that needle is threadable. The question, which I think sort of hinges on your point and is a good one, is all that different if Trump is actually running in a race, right? And it's not just sort of like, I like Mehmet Oz, so you got to vote for Mehmet Oz. It's like, you got to vote for, if you like me, you got to vote for me. And that might change everything. And that might be the reason why you're right and I'm wrong. But, and then the other complicating thing is everyone wants a fighter. And Trump, you try to game out how a debate works, where Trump says, I'm the fighter you need, blah, 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 blah. And then Pompeo or somebody says, yeah, but you lost. And, you had your shot. And then he says, yeah, but it was stolen from me. And then what does Pompeo say? Either it, no, it wasn't, or yeah, it was, but you didn't fight hard enough. I mean, then it becomes, you can go down a really dark tunnel towards crazy town about what happens in the GOP then. And it kind of blows everything up, because normally in politics, if you lose, you don't run again. And if you do run again, the charge against you is you had your shot and you lost. But by saying that the thing was stolen from him, it just scrambles all the wiring for all that. And it's very hard for me to game out.
Yeah. So this is where the punditry truly does become rank, but I'm all here for it. Jonah, let's game this out a little bit, because I think the last point you made is really the salient one. When you think about a lot of these local races, statewide races happening and primaries, the litmus test in many of them is, do you believe that the election was stolen? Yes or no? right? It's sort of a barrier to entry for anybody who answers that question the wrong way. We've seen that all over the country. And I've got to think that whoever winds up running in 2024 alongside Trump, assuming he runs, whether it's Pence, whether it's Pompeo, whether it's Cruz, whether it's Cotton or DeSantis, some combination of other folks. You remember in the very first debate in the 2016 Republican primary election cycle, the very first question Bret Baier asked everyone on stage in Cleveland, he said, because this was when Trump had been making noise about running a third party campaign if the RNC tried to rig things against him. So the very first question of the very first primary debate, Bret Baier said, I'd like to see a show of hands. Is there anybody on this stage tonight who will not commit to supporting the eventual nominee of the Republican Party? And Trump is the only guy who puts his hand up, right? And that's when the reality show really began in earnest. Mm-hmm. And you could see a similar question being posed in the first Republican debate. You know, can I see, if I was moderating it, I will say that I have moderated one presidential debate in my life. I may never be invited back to do another. But if I were moderating it, you can bet dollars to donuts. That'd be my first question. As a show of hands, can you all please tell me, does anybody here not believe that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, right? Or maybe phrase it a different way. Does anybody on this stage believe, can I see a show of hands, does anybody believe that Joe Biden was legitimately elected president of the United States, right? And away we go. Because to your point, Jonah, if nobody raises their hand, if nobody is willing to break from Trump on that message, then how can any of them effectively make the argument that it's not his turn anymore, right? That you had your chance and you lost and now it's time to exit stage left and let's move the party forward. If in fact they all agree with the premise that the election was stolen and that Donald Trump was cheated from the presidency, then isn't it his nomination to how could you argue that the nomination would not sort of fairly belong to him, right? Mm-hmm. That it is still his party. So it is a dark tunnel to take people down, but I think it's one that we could it's not far fetched at all.
Yeah, a friend of mine was telling me about I didn't see it, so if I'm getting it wrong, we'll put a correction. But apparently, Mastriano, this guy who just won the nomination in Pennsylvania, he did a talk radio or podcast interview immediately afterwards, and they were talking about how great it was and how awesome it'll be and what a great governor he'll be and yada, yada, yada. And then, as my friend explained it, the interviewer says, and we'll have 20 electoral votes in our pocket or something like that. And like, if, you know, like I get it's a binary choice when you're talking about president of the United States. I mean, I reject it, but I understand the argument about it, right? You know, I understood it in 2016 to be sure. Like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, man for all seasons, you know, the price of your soul, but for whales, you know, like the idea, like you got to vote for Mastriano in Pennsylvania when this guy is all but shouting from the rooftops that he is going to play games with, you know, stealing an election, you know, in favor that he will not consider any election that Donald Trump or the Republican doesn't win to be legitimate. And that's a scary thing for a Republican, you know, governor to say. That stuff is going to get worse before it gets better, it seems to me. And it's very, that wild card makes the primaries even more hard to kind of game out.
Yeah, it does. I mean, talk about saying the quiet part out loud. You've got Republicans all over the country who are kind of winking and nodding at voters saying that, you know, never again will we allow an election to get stolen. But yeah, 20 electoral votes. I mean, it's something. It's really something. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't say, you know, we're 6 months out from the midterms. Some things can change, but most of the fundamentals are pretty well baked in at this point. Economy starting to lag, recession around the corner, inflation through the roof, gas prices suck, food prices suck. You know, a lot of angst, a lot of uncertainty in the country. And that doesn't even get into, you know, crime and immigration and all these other things, right? So on paper, all of these fundamentals are squarely in the Republican Party's favor, and the wind is at their back, and there's no way that they should
do anything less than rout the Democrats at the polls in November, right, based on everything we know now, everything we know historically about the patterns of these things. And yet, here you have Republicans in some places, you know, in Pennsylvania, in my home state of Michigan, where you have, election fraud conspiratists on the statewide ballot now for attorney general and secretary of state. And this is happening in some other places as well, and it will continue to happen as the primary season plays out. Yeah. Arizona is a complete hot mess. You could see Republicans snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here in some of these races by nominating people who are nuts, mm-hmm, for lack of a better way of putting it. And that would really be something. I don't think that there's anything the Republican Party could do at this point to sabotage the takeover of the House of Representatives. I mean, the margins are just too small and Democrats are on defense in way too many seats. And even if Republicans were to nominate election conspiracy people in all of these races, dozens and dozens of them, I still think that they'd have enough of a margin where they're going to take over the House. But in a lot of these statewide races in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, Arizona, elsewhere, there's I think a real hope now among Democrats that the Republican overreach here, this belief that the environment is so good for Republicans that they can nominate anybody they want and still win, I think that's going to be tested. And I actually do think that Democrats are probably going to win a few of those races that they shouldn't otherwise win. And in fact, what the net result of it will also be, Jonah, is that you're going to have, I was just having this conversation with a really smart Republican in Michigan last week. He's involved in what's going to be a very hot congressional race here, very, very tight. And he was saying, listen, the margins down ballot are really going to be affected here because the statewide nominee for AG and for Secretary of State on the Republican side, these are people who are unfit for office, mm-hmm, just objectively. And you're going to see anywhere from, you know, maybe as small as 3-3.5% to maybe as much as, you know, 8 or 9% of kind of moderate, independent, center left, center right, however you want to view them, voters. There's no registration here, but you're going to see some not insignificant chunk of people who would have otherwise been predisposed to voting Republican this fall. They're going to vote Democrat, and they might vote Democrat all the way down the ballot. And if they do, the people who are going to be punished by Republicans nominating some of these crazy people are not just the crazy people themselves, but Republicans farther down the ballot. And maybe, this is wishful thinking, I'm sure, but when we think about the long game of this and things getting worse before they get better, maybe that's what starts the long road to getting better, is the fact that not crazy Republicans down the ballot are suffering because of the actions and the words of these crazy Republicans. And maybe it's those people who finally draw a line in the sand and say, okay, enough is enough. We've got to get back control of this thing because it's just doing too much damage. And again, that's probably wishful thinking.
It might be, it might not be, you know, as Edmund Burke says, example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other. Sometimes you just got to show people the folly of their mistakes. But on the other hand, I've been saying for, you know, it's basically Goldberg's rule of politics, which is that the best explanatory theory, it's not perfect, but it's the best one we've got for explaining both Democrat and Republican behavior the last few years, is both parties are just secretly determined to be minority parties. Right.
Yes.
I mean, like Joe Biden, I know we're running long, but like Joe Biden could have hugged Joe Manchin and governed as the return to normalcy president that he implicitly campaigned on and made the Democratic Party basically a majority party if they could get buy-in from the base for years to come. But he didn't do that. Right. The Republicans, I mean, like Mitch McConnell is open to all sorts of legitimate criticism, and I'm not here to defend him. But he is a grown-up, right? And he kind of does understand in a sort of cold, calculating way that it's really dumb to nominate really bad candidates. And yet the Republican Party is determined to, in state after state, nominate dumb candidates and embrace issues that turn off more voters than attract. And I think it has to do with the role of primaries and Fox News and cable news in general. But that's a subject for another remnant. But it is just amazing how, like, you're like, why are they doing this? And the only explanation that really has any teeth half the time is, oh, it's because secretly they want to be a minority party. And it's like, oh, that makes sense.
You know? you and I may have noodled on this before, Jonah, but it is just a relentless, ruthless race to the bottom. There is this crazy, I mean, and you may recall, I think it was the last time I was on your podcast, you and I discussed how I said to you, because I think it was late in 2020, it was probably right before the election, but I think I said to you that the worst thing that could happen to a President Joe Biden would be to have narrow control of the Senate.
That's right, you did.
The worst thing that could happen to his presidency. Yeah. Right. And that, of course, that's exactly what happened, right? Because he has a minority in name only. It's a mino. He doesn't have any margins. So if in fact, and I'm not saying that his political prospects would be sort of incandescent at this point, but you do have to think that if Biden had been given the sort of plausible deniability of a 51-49 Republican Senate, and he said to his people, look, I've got to work with Mitch. And then he and his old pal Mitch sort of went behind closed doors and tried to get some things done. I've got to suspect that the Democratic Party is better positioned politically, maybe significantly better positioned than they are today. And but you know, you look up and down the board and you know, I don't want to tease out too much of a reporting project that I'm in the middle of right now, but it's sort of focused on exactly this thing is like, how is it that this Democratic Party, in the face of an authoritarian, curious, QAnon loving Republican base that is poised yet again to nominate the most polarizing person in the world, how is it that they are backpedaling? How is it that they're playing defense? How is it that they're about to cede control of probably the House and the Senate this November? It's and all of these state house positions across the country. It's sort of unthinkable, except that it's not that unthinkable because we've seen the Republican Party do it in the very recent past, and we'll probably see them do it again in a couple of years. And just, you know, back and forth we go.
All right, we've gone long. I could do this all day. I hope you come back for Rank Punditry. And certainly when you're done with your next reporting project, you have an open invitation to come back on anytime you like.
Okay.
Tim Alberta, thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. And I hope to see you again.
Yeah, it was fun, Jonah. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Tim Alberta has left the studio. I anticipate getting a diverse set of responses about today's podcast. I look forward to some of them. But I liked him a lot. And I'm glad we got to get in some Rank Punditry. I have many more thoughts about a lot of this stuff, but I got to do a solo, remnant in the next 12 hours. So I'll probably save them for that. Thanks to everybody, for tuning in, and, the, 500th remnant is coming down the pike pretty soon. Very exciting. And, other than that, I'll just see you next time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast.